then got his degree at what was then City of London College. Is that music? I'm not sure what it is. Does anyone know? No. And then he came to Cambridge in 1976, and I guess he's been here ever since. Mm-hmm. Did his PhD here, and some postdoc work, and then since, I think, 1981, he's been a member of the academic staff here. And throughout that period, since he started his research, I think he's worked on phase transformations, solid-state transformations, in a whole host of different ways, and predominantly in ferrous metallurgy, but not always. And he's made himself world-renowned in that area. And I think we're very, very lucky tonight to have Harry talk to us. He's been described, as I said, one of the UK's leading and the world's leading academic researchers in ferrous metallurgy. He's written all sorts of things, numerous, far more publications than I think anyone else here can probably talk about. In 2006, the Institute of Materials, Minerals and Mining awarded him the Bessemer Gold Medal. And after receiving that, he gave the Bessemer Lecture back in September. It had the same title as tonight, but I don't think the content would be entirely the same. But on the other hand, I don't think there's anyone who was here, I wasn't there, who saw the previous lecture. So you might not be able to spot the changes. Sure. So Harry, over to you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jeff, for the nice introduction. And thank you all for coming. You know, the weather isn't ideal for such things, but thank you very much for coming. I'm very pleased to see so many people. I thought I would do something different today. You know, usually when I give lectures, I sort of sing the praises of what we have achieved and so on and so on. But what I want to show today is also the huge amount of basic work, which is really quite dull, which goes to create the science which enables us to produce really novel materials. Okay? So you will have to bear with me, and I will ask you questions as well. So the first question is, you know, how many different crystal structures do we have for iron? Sorry?
Iron.
Pure iron. Maybe it is. Which are they?
Basin, cubic, and medicine.
Well done. Actually, that's two out of three. Yeah. So these are what we think are the most common allotropes of iron. The cubic closed back of. Yeah, sure. The face-ended cubic and the body-centered cubic structure. This is known as ferrite, and this is known as austenite. But this also occurs, the hexagonal closed back form. So if you look at your stainless steel spoons very carefully, you'll find this also in there. And of course, in pure iron, this is stable at very, very high pressures, okay, about 300,000 atmospheres of pressure. You get a transition from either of these to this. So this is the highest density form of iron. Epsilon. Okay. So these are the allotropes of iron. And we can actually change from one allotrope to another by means of a phase transformation. And in the case of the hexagonal form and the face-centered cubic form, it's very easy to see how it happens. You know, you can think of a hexagonal form of iron as a stacking of AB, AB, AB closed back layers. Right? And austenite, which is cubic closed back, is simply ABC, ABC, ABC stacking. So if you shift these layers appropriately, you will get this structure. Now, of course, this is approximate, because there is also a density difference between these two structures. So there is a relaxation normal to those closed back planes, which is important, but which we don't teach, because this is a hard sphere model, and in a hard sphere model, both of them have exactly the same density. Okay, so we've said there are three allotropes of iron, okay, and we think that the ferrite and the austenite are the most common. But you know, there is actually a huge lump of iron, which is about the quarter of the diameter of Earth, right in the middle of the Earth, okay, and that has a very interesting structure. It's known as a double hexagonal closed back structure. So the core of the Earth is about half the diameter, and there's liquid, but in the middle the pressure is about 300 gigapascals, and the temperature can be something of the order of 7,000 Kelvin. Right in the middle, we have this, what is believed to be a double hexagonal closed back structure, which does this: ABAC ABAC ABAC, instead of ABABAB for hexagonal closed back. Now, how do we know that this is double hexagonal closed back? Well, you can do experiments using diamond anvils and so forth to create that sort of pressure and temperature on top of the Earth. You never actually get to the conditions that exist right in the core of the Earth by doing those experiments. The pressures and temperatures are just too high in the middle. But first principles calculations on iron indicate that it could be double hexagonal closed packed, or it could be hexagonal closed packed right in the middle of the Earth. A very large chunk of solid iron. So that might be the most common form of iron, actually. Yeah, not austenite, not ferrite, or even the epsilon iron. If I just go back to this hexagonal form of iron, this is going to become more prominent in the near future, because there are certain very special alloys known as TWIP alloys, TWIP, twinning induced plasticity alloys, which are heavily contain large concentrations of manganese. Something of the order of 30 atomic percent. And those can transform very easily into the epsilon structure. And those are going to make it into cars in the near future. So there's an enormous amount of research and development, in fact. The research has been done, the development process, to put these alloys into cars. Because, you know, the sort of shear that you have in a twin is far greater than you have in martensitic transformations or bainitic transformations and so on. So you can use that shear to get plasticity.
Okay. Well, I just have a question of your left topic. Is it possible to make any assumption about the grain size in your
own? Very good question. Very good question. It would be great if it was a single crystal.
Well,
it's been there for a very long time.
I assume it would be possible to say something about that from the sound or shockwave acoustics or something.
I haven't found any literature to say whether it's a single crystal or not. But it's been there, it's been cooking for such a long time at high temperatures, you know?
Well, they say it could be a relatively small number of single crystals.
Yeah, could be. I imagine, you know, that the magnetic field could be used to decide whether it's a large crystal or many small crystals. But I haven't seen any literature on the subject, because all of these allotropes are magnetic, you'll see shortly. Okay.
Didn't Jules Verne find out?
I must read novels, okay? Okay, right, so the largest lump might actually be in the middle of the Earth. Now, it's very interesting, you know, we can now play about with these first principles calculations to try crystal structures which don't actually exist, at least in our domain of knowledge. So here are the usual culprits, you know, body centered cubic, hexagonal closed packed, and cubic closed packed. What's the night? This is primitive hexagonal. Okay, so the difference between this and this is that we don't have this atom over there. So there's only atoms at the corners. This is just primitive cubic. Okay, no face centering, no body centering. And this is diamond form of iron. Now you can relatively easily do calculations to see the energies of these structures. And why would you want to do them? Well, first of all, you want to find what is the most stable structure at zero Kelvin, say. That you decide by saying, look, this has the lowest energy. This particular structure here is hexagonal closed back, has the lowest energy. Then you can say, supposing I want to do something to this structure to alloy it, for example, and create one of these strange crystal structures. You know, for example, the diamond crystal structure of iron. Yeah. Why would we want to do that? Because this has a density of only 5 grams per centimeter cubed, compared with about 7.8 grams per centimeter cubed. You could look at diagrams like this and decide whether the gap here is unrealistically large to try something to create the diamond form of iron or not. And unfortunately, it is just huge, that gap between the energies. But can anybody spot a mistake in this diagram? This is actually calculations done some time ago by Paxton, who used to be in this department. Is there anything wrong with this diagram?
Somewhat confused about the relative close packing.
Yeah. And you know, is this really the most stable form of iron? Is this the ground state of iron? It isn't, you know, it's body-centered qubit. Yeah? So there's something wrong with these calculations. And what's wrong with these calculations is that they don't include magnetic properties. Okay? And magnetism plays such a huge role in iron. You will see that, you know, the very strange behavior we get, body-centered qubit being stable at high temperatures, then face-centered qubit, and then body-centered qubit, it simply wouldn't happen without the magnetic properties. Okay, so the energies associated with the magnetic transitions are actually greater than with the crystal structure changes that you get. When you include magnetic properties, of course, you get the right ground state, which is the body-centered qubit iron. It's very interesting, you know, supposing that iron had been hexagonal close-packed, yeah, we wouldn't have civilization. You all know that, you know, hexagonal close-packed usually has very few slip systems, right? So it's not going to be a ductile material. And the twib steels that I mentioned earlier, you know, they deform by twinning, mostly by twinning, not by ordinary plasticity. So, you know, without magnetism, we wouldn't have civilization as we know it. And you can see that, you know, if I remove all the unnecessary elements from the periodic table and focus on iron, these are the iron analogs, because they have the right sort of electronic structure to behave chemically like iron. So here we have ruthenium, osmium, hassium. We don't know very much about this. But the point is that, you know, iron just happens to be the right sort of size to allow exchange interactions between atoms and get these magnetic properties. When you get to ruthenium and osmium, they are paramagnetic. Okay, so they don't have, you know, they wouldn't be attracted by a magnet. And they have the hexagonal close-packed structure, which is predicted by those first principles calculations. Okay. So ruthenium and osmium are both hexagonal close-packed materials. I'd like to just show you this. These are the various transition temperatures in ordinary iron, okay, pure iron. So we know that when liquid solidifies, it solidifies first to body-centered cubic iron at a temperature like this. You can force it to solidify to austenite instead by having a sufficiently large cooling rate so that you miss out this transformation. But then the austenite again transforms back into ferrite and, you know, various transformations. These are magnetic temperatures. So this is the Curie temperature in ferrite. There are two temperatures here, the Curie temperature in austenite and the Neel temperature in austenite. I'll explain that to you later. But one of the things that I'd like to point out, you know, there's a lot of teachers here as well, is that you'll find these temperatures quoted differently in different textbooks. And that's because, you know, the practical temperature scale was revised in 1968 by increasing the melting point of palladium by 2 degrees. So if you read several books, you'll find variations of the order of 2 degrees in these temperatures. So this is the corrected scale. Okay, so let's look at these magnetic properties in a little bit more detail. And here is some very simple theory. You know, imagine you've got an electron spinning around. You can think of it as a little current, and therefore you have a little magnet, and that's a Bohr magneton. Okay, that's a unit of magnetism. And depending on how these pins actually align, you get ferromagnetic, which is the normal sort of behavior of ferritic iron. You put a magnet and it gets attracted to you, all the spins are aligned. This is antiferromagnetism, where they're aligned in opposite directions. This is ferrimagnetic, that means this is smaller than this. Okay. And this is paramagnetic, where, you know, it's always impossible to draw random things, but this is supposed to be random, okay, random orientations. Now, the interesting thing is that if we measure the magnetic moment of an atom of iron, okay, in the ferritic structure, it's about 2.2 Bohr magnetons. If I make my ferrite very thin, it's very large. It's about 3.1 Bohr magnetons. And if I do these measurements on austenite, then I can get two different values, okay, 2.8 and 0.6, which is very strange. Okay. And you might ask, you know, how are these measurements made? Because I can't actually get austenite stable in pure iron at room temperature to do these measurements. Well, you deposit films of iron on a copper substrate, then it's forced to adopt the copper structure. So you basically get austenite, a thin film of austenite at room temperature. And because the lattice parameter of copper is slightly different from that of iron, it will be distorted. So this is like a face-centered tetragonal form of iron. And if you deposit it on the 111 plane, you'll get a trigonal form of iron. So there's two more allotropes. So, you know, we are building up the number of allotropes that you mentioned from two into a large number. So what we've got to explain is, you know, this is particularly interesting. Why do we have these two different magnetic moments? And why, when we make the film thin, do we get a very large magnetic moment? That would be very, very useful to Rolls-Royce, for example, to have something which has a much higher ability to magnetize. Okay. Well, what happens is by studying these very small magnets of austenite, in other words, thin films of austenite, or particles of iron which are precipitated inside copper, so they coherently maintain the FCC crystal structure. What happens is that when you deposit the iron on a hot copper substrate, only on a hot copper substrate, it's ferromagnetic. And when you deposit iron on a copper gold alloy, which is not hot, but it has a large lattice parameter because the gold expands the lattice parameter of copper, it's still ferromagnetic. So this indicates that, you know, when the volume of the cell of austenite is large, it's ferromagnetic. And when the volume is small, so I deposit it on pure copper at room temperature, I get the antiferromagnetic domain. So it appears that there are two states, two electronic states for the atoms in austenite. One is antiferromagnetic and the other is ferromagnetic, and the Curie temperature here is about 1300 Kelvin, and this is about 80 Kelvin. Those have been measured. And one has a high density, a low density and a high density. Now this explains an enormous amount about iron. So this is a simple dielectrometer curve where we take a sample of steel, we heat it up, and then we cool it down. This is the heating part, so here we are measuring the expansion coefficient of ferrite, whereas here we are measuring the expansion coefficient of austenite. Now, all intuition would tell you that the expansion coefficient of austenite should be smaller than that of ferrite. This is showing exactly the opposite. Yeah? That austenite has a much larger expansion coefficient than ferrite. And this is technologically very important, because what happens is that we are trying to design power plant with steam temperatures in excess of 600 degrees centigrade. With the body centered cubic iron, we've managed to get to 620 degrees centigrade. But I would say that it probably isn't possible to go higher than that, because the creep rates increase rapidly. Okay? But if we had austenite, we could go to 700 degrees centigrade easily. But this large thermal expansion coefficient gives us thermal fatigue. So it makes the material useless for high temperature service in power plant. And imagine the efficiency improvements if you could go to 700 degrees centigrade steam temperatures in power plant. Okay. Now, what's happening is that we have these two electronic states. Okay, and they're separated by a small energy gap. And as we raise the temperature, you know, the low density state is favored over the high density state. So the thermal expansion coefficient that we are picking up is really an average of these two, depending on the proportions of the states occupied as a function of temperature. This, incidentally, is one of my ex-PhD students, Tracy Kuhl, which is 1.57 meters high, to give you an idea of what a steam turbine looks like. And it's when it's operating, it goes around at 3000 RPM with steam temperatures of the order of 600 degrees centigrade. So this is what is really happening, is that you have this high-density state of austenite, low-density state of austenite, and what you're picking up is an average expansion coefficient. But if you look at the expansion coefficients here and here, they're very similar to that of ferrite. Now, of course, this is also consistent with the Invar effect, where you can produce a zero thermal expansion coefficient, because although this is for pure iron, we can modify the states by adding alloying elements as well. So, you know, minute effects, you know, which come from very basic science, have immense consequences on the design of steels for engineering purposes. Okay, let's have a look again at this table. So we haven't yet explained why we have this very large magnetization for a thin film of ferrite. But basically, you know, when you start to take a piece of metal and you cut it and cut it until it becomes very small, as you make it smaller and smaller, it's getting nearer to being not a metal. In other words, the electrons are no longer being shared as effectively as when you have large numbers of atoms. So this, the technical term for this is hybridization of the electrons. So when we have a thin film, we are reducing the coordination number of the iron atoms. And therefore, it's behaving more like a single atom than a metallic state. And a single atom of iron has a greater degree of magnetization than bulk iron. And that is the reason why we have this very large magnetization in thin films. The substrate, you know, because it's copper, doesn't interfere with this. You know, there's no hybrid, no significant hybridization between the electrons in the substrate and in the thin film. The other interesting point is that the spins all align normal to this thin film. And that's a much more complicated thing to explain by waving hands, because it involves interactions between the spin and the orbital of the electron. But quantum mechanics can easily explain why the spins all align normal to that thin film. Okay, slight change of topic. Now I want to, you know, I've talked about two dimensions. I want to talk about fractional dimensions. And you know, this is one of the first movies. Do you recognize what this is?
This is Leia.
Yeah, you recognize Princess Leia, but this is a Star Wars movie, okay? Yeah. So this image, you see, of a planet looks so realistic.
Yeah.
You compare that with some of the old movies where, you know, you have a smooth object, mm-hmm. Because we are using geometry to model the planet instead of the concept of roughness. Okay. So this concept is very important in material science. And here is an example to illustrate that. Supposing we want to measure the perimeter of the coastline of Britain. And you ask somebody to walk around the coastline and count the number of steps. And if it's an adult, they will have a large step length. Okay. Then you ask a child to do the same thing. They will not produce the same perimeters.
Poor child.
But you know, some of these are tough. One of them just rode across the Atlantic, you know? 12-year-old, I believe, 14 years old. So anyway, the child will measure a much larger perimeter than the adult, because this is not what you call a smooth object. This is a rough object, and the greater your resolution, the smaller the step size, the more the nooks and crannies into which you can step. Yeah? Whereas an adult would step over them. And there are so many problems in materials which are like this, where, say, for example, if you want to look at the interaction of gas molecules with a catalyst, you can't measure the surface area using, you know, a planimeter or something. You have to measure using a resolution corresponding to those molecules. And by doing this measurement at a variety of resolutions and plotting a graph like this, this is Mandelbrot's work, you get a parameter called the fractal dimension, which is a fractional dimension, which is different from, you know, the normal topological dimension. So for a sphere, for example, you know, the area would be precisely, the surface area would be precisely 4 pi r squared. That wouldn't be the case for a gooseberry, okay, which has a rough surface. Now, this is one of my favorite subjects. This is looking at an optical micrograph of bainite. And when you look at an optical micrograph, that looks like a plate of bainite, a single plate of bainite. If I now show you the same thing at a much higher resolution, you see it consists of thousands of tiny platelets. Okay. And this is a bit like a fractal, that we have a roughness here. If I measured the surface area of these plates at this resolution, I would get a completely different answer from this resolution. And if I go to even higher resolution, I'll get a different answer. So what we did is we did these measurements, and just to illustrate to you, this is at 1 micrometers. If I take lots of these and put them together and look at a greater magnification, it still looks like a plate. So that's the concept of self-similarity. And I'd like to know, you know, how far can we go by increasing resolution and still find the structure? So we did these experiments, and we found the fractal dimension to be, you know, 3.59 instead of 3. In other words, it's not a smooth object. Okay. But 3.59 isn't really a true fractal. That means that there is a limit to which it still has this plane structure. If it was a true fractal, that means I can indefinitely increase the resolution and get smaller and smaller plates, then the surface per unit volume would scale like this. Okay. So physical objects, I don't know of any physical object which shows true fractal behavior. Okay. They will be somewhere in between the topological dimension and this kind of roughness. The point of this is that, look, if I now want to predict the mechanical properties of this steel, I have to think about what property I want to look at. You know, if I'm looking at stress corrosion and chemical attack, then I need to look at this sort of resolution because it's a chemical interaction. Okay. If I'm looking at dislocation plasticity, dislocations have a line tension, so they can't really bend as much as, you know, individual molecules can. So I need to look at this resolution to measure the surface area. And if I'm looking at a meteorite, which has cooled at, you know, 1 Kelvin per million years, then it's very close to equilibrium, and this will be very, very smooth. This is a picture I took at the Smithsonian in Washington of a chunk of meteorite, and that's the structure that you see inside there. And that, you know, if you've cooled at such a slow rate from a very high temperature, it's not going to be a rough interface. Okay? It's simply that in our case, in order to produce strange properties, we produce very non-equilibrium structures. So this is the concept of fractal dimensions and fractional dimensions. Let me now go on to work that was done in an MPhil project here, just simply from a coffee room chat with the people who work on nanotubes, where they find tiny particles of iron inside the nanotubes, because they use a gas called ferrocene to catalyze these formation of these nanotubes. In order to define the melting temperature in thermodynamics, you simply plot the free energy of the liquid and of the solid, and you get a melting temperature. Okay. But this assumes that you have really large particles of liquid and solid. The interface doesn't play a big role. Now, supposing I make the particles very tiny, then I have to take account of that interface energy that's required as the particle grows. It's a very well-known phenomenon known as capillarity. And the effect of capillarity is to add extra energy to the solid that forms, and therefore you depress the melting temperature. Okay. So you can, in principle, you know, melt iron at very low temperatures if you're looking at very tiny particles. Now, whether that is what explains this blobby nature, or whether it's surface diffusion or whatever, we don't actually know. But in principle, you know, this particle of iron inside this nanotube should have a low melting temperature. Now, sticking to the subject of nanotubes, you know, you can actually get strengths of the order of 130 gigapascals in these tubes. And the modulus along the length has been measured, you know, to be incredibly large, of the order of 1.2 terapascals. Compare with steel, you know, this is 200 gigapascals, and the maximum theoretical strength of steel is of the order of 25 gigapascals. Okay, so this is something which is an unimaginably high strength and a particular direction, the modulus. Now, there are lots and lots of claims about these carbon nanotubes, which I will show you a newspaper article later. What I want to say is that I don't think that even in principle it is possible to scale up these nanotubes and get those properties that I illustrated. And the reason why it's not possible is that entropy comes into this. You know, as soon as you start to scale up, you have a larger number of entities, and the probability of a defect occurring increases dramatically, because say this is the defect energy. That will oppose the formation of a defect, but the entropy term favors the formation of a defect. That's why we have vacancies in metals. Doesn't matter how long you anneal a metal, there will be vacancies. That's why we can get diffusion. So these two terms oppose each other, and therefore you will always have an equilibrium density of defects. And I think that this is the reason why, you know, when we take single crystals of iron, for example, whiskers of iron, tiny whiskers of iron, we can get huge strength, but the strength then collapses as we increase the size. And similarly, I don't know of any nanotube rope greater than 2 millimeters, which has achieved a strength greater than about 2,000 megapascals. And I don't know whether even in principle it's possible. This is how the strength of whiskers of iron collapses as you increase the size, because again, entropy favors the existence of defects. And you know, I don't think we need to worry in the steel business about articles like this, you know, where they claim there are engineers salivating about these tubes replacing steel. You know, comparisons are made against steel which are completely false. You cannot scale from tiny things to something which is orders of magnitude larger, many orders of magnitude larger, and say you will maintain those properties. I now want to talk about mixtures of dimensions. Again, the interaction of the engineering scale with very tiny scales. So let's imagine we have a problem, okay? And the problem is to design a bulk nanocrystalline steel, which is very strong, tough, and cheap. Now, it's very easy to make this statement. Yeah. It's the kind of thing you put in a research proposal. I want to put some meat onto this. And I want to say, look, when I mean bulk, I mean large, you know, that's the size of a human being. Okay. When I mean strong, I want to get to a scale in the microstructure which is like this, okay, and properties which are really impressive. And when I say cheap, it should be weight for weight cheaper than bottled water. Okay. So let's let's talk about that problem. Well, many people have tried to make nanocrystalline steel or nanocrystalline metals, and you can find, you know, unbelievably large numbers of papers on this subject, and vast quantities of money have been devoted, but you run up against a very, very simple problem. That as you start to make the grain size, polycrystalline material, smaller and smaller, you lose plastic stability. You know, the material becomes unstable, and the uniform ductility that you get is negligible. If I go to even smaller grain sizes, you get virtually almost like brittle failure. And this can be reproduced in many, many nanocrystalline materials. The material loses the ability to work harden. That's basically what it corresponds to. Somehow it has lost the ability to work harden, and therefore it cannot compensate for perturbations in dimensions, and you develop plastic instabilities. Now, one reason why this happens, perhaps the most important reason, is that of course as you make the crystal size smaller and smaller, the fraction of space occupied by the boundaries themselves increases. Okay? Now, boundaries are very good sinks for dislocations. So what you are doing effectively is you are eliminating dislocations from your structure. If you eliminate dislocations, the work hardening mechanism is lost, and therefore you don't get work hardening. And there's a very elegant experiment reported very recently where they took a tiny particle of ferrite, body-centered cubic iron, very small particle, and forced it to shear, you know, by putting it between platens and then doing this. And it refused to deform. Instead, it transformed to austenite at room temperature. So when we make the crystal size very small in a polycrystalline material, you lose the ability for work hardening, and therefore it's of little use in an engineering sense. So what we've got to do is we've got to introduce work hardening into the system. That's very, very important, okay, the ability to work harden. The second topic, which I won't go into, is that when you try to produce this on a large scale, you've got to have a mechanism for getting rid of the energy that is released when you get a transformation to produce a small crystal size. So we need to store that heat inside the material, and we can do that in the form of elastic strains. We need to reduce the rate of phase transformations, and we need to transform at as low a temperature as possible, because that ensures lots of nucleation and fine scales, dimensional scales. Yeah. One person, you know, asked me, is this going to be about oxide scales or dimensional scales? Right, so let me just quickly summarize how we are going to do this. We are going to do this using bainite, and this is basically the mechanism of the transformation, that you start off exactly like martensite, but the carbon is able to partition because it is an interstitial atom and can diffuse rapidly, and then it precipitates as cementite between these plates of ferrite. This is a bad thing. The cementite particles in high-strength materials are brittle. But we can get rid of this by alloying with silicon, which prevents the precipitation of cementite. Okay. So here you are, we add silicon, and instead of cementite, we end up with nice layers of austenite. So the question then arises, you know, what is the lowest temperature at which I can produce bainite? Okay. Theoretically, what is the lowest temperature? Now, you know that simple diagram that I showed you of the mechanism? There's a lot of theory behind it, which allows us to calculate nucleation, growth, and many, many phenomena associated with bainite. So I won't go into those at all, but here are some calculations showing the temperature at which bainite starts to form. And of course, if we want to form bainite, we've got to also suppress the martensite start temperature. And here you are. We are okay because we've got a gap between the bainite and the martensite start. Now, according to this, I could produce bainite at room temperature. If I made an alloy of this sort of composition, I could produce it at room temperature. Of course, that has never before been done, but according to theory, this can be done. Now, there is a catch here, and that is kinetics. If I wanted to produce it at room temperature, I would require about 100 years. Okay. So we have made something a bit more practical, which would take maybe a couple of weeks to form bainite. And here you go. So this was the alloy made to validate those calculations. I want you to focus on the carbon concentration, which is high by conventional standards. The silicon is simply there to suppress cementite. The molybdenum is because we'll always have impurities which cause embrittlement, and molybdenum gathers those impurities and various other things. And the heat treatment is very simple. We just produce austenite and then we isothermally transform in a pizza oven. Yeah. These temperatures are actually lower in some cases than what you use for making pizza. Of course, we are going to leave them in the oven for a long time. Just to show you a comparison between the calculated time for transformation and the measured time. And this is the optical microstructure. It doesn't look, it's a beautiful microstructure, but, you know, I wouldn't write home about it. We've seen it before. But when we measure the properties of these, they are amazing. So I want you to look at this next slide. You know, take a deep breath. It is really exciting. Yeah. So here you are. this is what it looks like in a transmission electron microscope. This is about 200 angstroms in thickness. So we produce bainite at the lowest temperature ever reported, about 125 degrees centigrade to 200 degrees centigrade. And the finest scale ever, separated by these beautiful films of austenite. And the scale is actually smaller than, you know, a multi-volt carbon nanotube. It's just normal, conventional transmission electron microscopy. You know, nothing special. So that's produced at a quarter of the homologous temperature. Okay, and we've got these plates, which are 20 to 40 nanometers in thickness. And of course, they're long, but the mean free slip distance is about the thickness. This is the hardest ever bainite produced. You know, this beats the vast majority of martensitic steels in hardness, and we can even get 750. There are no brittle carbides, and it's interesting, you know, this is designed using theory alone. Okay. And very good properties. I'd like to sort of continue on this, but I want to explain why this is ductile. Yeah. It is ductile, qualitatively it's ductile, because we have these austenite films which transform under the influence of stress, so we get transformation-induced plasticity, and that is a major work hardening mechanism. So we've got rid of the problem of no work hardening. Here's a couple of stress strain curves from that material. This is the true stress and the engineering stress, and I can show you another one where we have, you know, quite a lot of ductility. But we get these large variations in ductility depending on how we do the experiments. Why is that happening? So here, for example, you know, you can see the range of ductility depending on transformation temperature. This is the retained austenite content. What we think is happening is that, look, when I plot the observed uniform strain, and almost all the strain is uniform, against the fraction of austenite, I don't get an intercept at zero. I get it at a finite fraction of austenite. So here are those three cases where this is the amount of austenite in the sample at a strain of zero, and this is how it varies as we pull the material. It's undergoing a phase change to martensite, transformation induced plasticity, giving us work hardening. If I now plot the failure strains on here, then they are roughly about 10%. And there are other data which confirm this, that fracture happens when I get to about 10% of retained austenite. Now why is that? Okay, this is just a neutron diffraction experiment where we pull the tensile specimen in a source. And again, it verifies approximately 10% of retained austenite where fracture occurs. Okay, so let's imagine that we have these blue squares and white squares. Now, in this case, we have sufficient fraction of space occupied by the blue squares that I can draw continuous lines from one end to the other just through the blue squares. So we say that here, you know, the fraction of blue is about the percolation threshold. If you now look at the red squares here, I cannot draw continuous lines through this. So the idea is that when we lose percolation in the austenite, the specimen fractures. Now of course, these are anisotropic structures, not like the ones I've illustrated here, but the theory exists for that. You know, we can calculate the percolation threshold, that means the point at which we lose continuity, using that theory. And it roughly corresponds to the 10% of austenite that I was talking about. This is 1 upon the percolation threshold. So we need to do more work to verify this, because then we can use this knowledge to design an even more ductile structure. This particular material also has strengthens enormously at high strain rates. So this is work, this is the first time the Cavendish laboratory has done work on bainite. Okay? So what they've done is they've done measurements of the properties at very high strain rates. And any deviation from this straight line implies, you know, that you're no longer elastic. So here you're looking at, you know, 10 gigapascals as the yield point. Okay, so at very high strain rates, the yield point increases dramatically, and at a sufficiently high velocity of the Hopkinson bar experiment, you also get a phase change into epsilon ion. But this, of course, suggests an application, which is armor, and this material performs actually extremely well. I'm not told what this serious battlefield threat is, but this is the actual people have started calling this super bainite, right? This is the actual armor made out of super bainite, and this would normally be destroyed by this particular threat. I have been given these data, which is a measure of the performance of the armor, where the higher the ballistic mass efficiency, and that takes account of mass, the better the armor is. So this is what we currently use. This is titanium armor, this is alumina, and this is the new super bainite. Alumina can only take one shot. This is capable of taking multiple shots. Yesterday, we had an incredibly exciting meeting at Rolls-Royce. We've been working on a project with them to put this into the shaft of an aero engine. This is a picture that I actually took at Heathrow Airport. And, you know, this lady came to me and said, you shouldn't be taking pictures, even though, you know, there's no sign saying no photographs. And the point I want to show is that, look, this is the size of a truck, this is the size of an aero engine. Okay? And in order to reduce the noise levels, the inlet here will become even larger. So the torque on the shaft becomes enormous, and there's no material at the moment capable of sustaining the design that we want in 20 years' time. And believe it or not, you know, Rolls-Royce is sponsoring a project for an engine to be made 20 years ahead. Okay? To me, that's long term, you know. And the material that is being worked on by Matthew, is this super bainite for the shaft. And the meeting yesterday was exciting but also frightening, because they're planning to put it into a test engine early 2009. So we don't have as much confidence in our material as the engineers over there have. There are applications in mining, because the wear resistance in both South Africa and Sweden. Armor is already established in the UK, but the US is now getting interested. And I've got visitors coming from Lockheed to talk more about the super bainite. And there are plenty of universities also working on this. And one of the things that one of the universities is working on is that I made a prediction at a conference in the USA that it isn't even in principle possible to make this using lower carbon concentrations. Because, you know, when I have a large carbon concentration, when I suppress the transformation temperature by increasing carbon, I keep a separation between these two. But when I try to suppress it using other elements than carbon, then they merge, and there's good reason in the theory for this. Okay, so this is just a prediction. Of course, when you make a prediction like that, people want to prove you wrong. So there are now experiments going on to see whether these are correct and whether or not we can make super bainite with a low carbon concentration, which would have advantages from the point of view of joining. Okay, so just to finish off, this is the structure. It's very strong and has a huge uniform ductility. It doesn't require any deformation at all to produce. It doesn't require any rapid heat treatment. So you take it out of a furnace at 1,000 degrees and gently walk over to this pizza oven. There's no rapid cooling required, so no residual stresses produced by the quenching operations. And from the point of view of the aircraft engine shaft, that is an incredibly important thing. It's very cheap. I mean, it's cheaper than bottled water, definitely. There's nothing unusually expensive in the alloying elements we are using. And Matthew has done an experiment in which he's obtained a uniform properties in an 80 millimeter large section, and his calculations show we could go to 120 millimeters big in all dimensions. Okay, so not a few dimensions. But going back to this, you know, we predicted that it would take 100 years for this sample to transform into bainite. Now, universities are even longer term than Rolls-Royce. Yeah? So we have made this material. Here it is. And it is sealed up in two quartz tubes. One is kept in my office, and the other one is in the Science Museum in London. And the way you would spot whether transformation has happened or not is that the surface will change, because this transformation causes displacement. So you can actually go and check and report back to me whether the transformation has happened or not, but the experiment will be completed in 2104. Mm. Okay.
Absolutely fascinating. And one thing I really wanted to ask, when you said this stuff, this material is cheap, if you go to large scale production, I can't imagine that the company producing this material can afford to store it for a month.
Very
even
good
at
question.
Elevated temperature,
to
produce large amounts.
Yesterday, we were talking about exactly this, because now 6 tons, no, is it 10 tons or 6 tons?
6 tons.
Have been ordered by Rolls-Royce to be made by Corus. Yeah. And from the point of view of Rolls-Royce, where residual stresses are very important, they have no problem in giving a 2-week heat treatment. Yeah. And they even have the technology to make that continuous. At first, of course, we are only going to make 6 shafts. But later on, you know, if it's successful, then they are not concerned about setting up the technology to have a continuous output from large ovens.
Okay.
But if you want to make this fast, we can do it. Yeah. So we added elements which increase the free energy change, and we can do this in hours. My own feeling is, you know, be patient and you will not have stresses to allow for.
Harriet, not a question, a comment concerning the possibility of welding the superbainite. I don't know whether you would be allowed to cool down to ambient temperature or not, but in principle, if you were able to carry out your arc welding by some mechanized process where you could do it at a temperature of about 400 Celsius, and if the second phase particles that necessarily you would introduce in the weld metal didn't influence the transformation behavior greatly, you could have your weld metal not transforming at the holding temperature, and then transform the whole structure upon completion
right.
of the welding.
Yeah. So, you know, I also made the unfortunate comment at this conference that this is not weldable. So, of course, people like you have started welding it, and what they do is they give it a preheat of about 200 degrees centigrade.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's quite common in welding.
Yes.
Yeah, preheat of 200.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fully austenitic, you know, while
yeah,
they're welding.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
And then you have to put the component into a furnace
yeah.
at 200
yes.
so that it doesn't actually cool before the bainite
sure.
reforms.
Yes, yes. Okay.
When you use a shaft, is that the casing or?
It's the thing which transmits the torque from the.
Oh, yeah, it's an axis. So
yeah.
Okay, yes. Okay.
So the power is produced where the fuel is burnt, but then it has to turn the fan which pulls the air in.
Mm. When you show the microstructure of the matrix and the platelets of the 200 nanometer kaolin platelets, what would be, from the point of view of failure, what would be the mechanism of failure? How are those rods contributing to failure?
Yeah. You see, the reason why I showed the optical micrograph first is that, unfortunately, this TEM picture is misleading. You know, this is actually, macroscopically, it's an isotropic structure. When we look on a very fine scale, you're picking up a few plates which are aligned. But your question is still a good one, because we haven't done the work to look at the very close to the fracture surface using transmission microscopy and so on. Absolutely good question.
Fiber strengthened materials commonly achieve, or generally achieve properties somewhat intermediate between the properties of two constituent parts. Can you conceive of a way of using carbon nanotubes to create fiber strengthened materials whereby you could exploit some of their superb strength?
We have the expert over there. I'm not a composites person, I'm afraid. Go on. Yeah.
In fact, that's why I asked the question. I was wondering if I put this first nanotube like this on some kind of matrix and understand what would be the contribution to failure of the whole material.
Harry, supposing we don't want to wait to 2104, it doesn't fit in the span of the current research assessment exercise. Why don't we irradiate the material? Not as as a way of making the shaft in the Rolls-Royce engine, but
right.
just for fundamental stuff.
Yeah, I that would be a good thing because that enhances kinetics, doesn't it?
And doesn't affect the thermodynamics.
Yeah. Good point.
Put some depleted uranium in and make it self
fire
accelerating.
I've said the most peculiar aspect of your invention, in my opinion, is that instead of wanting as high as possible quenching, you want it as slow as possible. It's quite a counterintuitive approach to the whole thing.
Yeah. Basically, we are suppressing the transformation temperature, so thermal activation is much reduced. You know, the normal temperature that the bainite forms is, you know, more than 400 degrees centigrade.
So and your 100-year experiment certainly beats my 4-year experiment.
You had a question?
Yes. When you mentioned Rolls-Royce is going to use that in the shaft, is that the one driving the big fan, which is the low pressure turbine, and then driving the big fan?
Ideally, you want one continuous shaft.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking
this material will not be stable at high temperatures.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of what are the temperatures seen at the shaft during service, and how would that affect the life or performance, the peak, whatever.
Yeah, so Matthew is currently doing work to look at what would be the maximum tolerable temperature, because we require transient blips into 400 degrees centigrade. So that work is incomplete.
Does super bainite have a ductile brittle transition temperature?
You know, all the data I've reported to you are on dirty seals. For the shaft, it's gone through aircraft quality processing, and we need to measure those properties in terms of temperature dependence and so on. At the moment, only the K1C measurements have been done at room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a question out of curiosity. This is not on super bainite, but on austenite. A few years ago, I had a steel plate inserted in my wrist, and the consultant assured me that because it was austenitic steel, it wouldn't be magnetic, so I wouldn't set off any of these metal detectors at airports and things. But I mean, your experiment showed that there were two values for the magnetization, so presumably it's in the one of the lower magnetic moment.
Yes, you would have something like 30 atomic percent of nickel in your stainless steel for it to become ferromagnetic. At the moment you have about 8, so I think you're okay.
Maybe it's a stupid question for that simple, but you mentioned the meteorites which lose temperature with about 1 Kelvin per 100 million years, or I don't know what, and I was thinking, of course, there is no connection, but what about the radiation? Where does it lose temperature faster than it
does? Yeah, I've seen all these calculations of cooling rates, but I haven't gone into them in detail. I mean, does anybody know why meteorites cool so slowly? Just big mass, maybe.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was the prior austenite grain size?
But it's huge.
Yes.
Of course, if it cools like a planet, then I can imagine it's true.
Thank you. Yes. That's it. Well, I'd just like to say, extremely fascinating. Not at all what I was expecting, but a whole host of intriguing things in it, and using a whole I think, range of different scientific principles. So, extremely interesting, Harry. Thank you very much indeed.
Safe journey home.
Just to say, next meeting is the 15th of March.